ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So we've done our 3 15-second shakes.
Yep.
And we're going to now take the lid off this little container, and I'm afraid they're our sacrifice bees. And we'll just shake off the
And we
extra.
Have our fingers crossed that there's nothing in that liquid at the
look,
base.
Well, it's going to happen one day. Will it be today? Going to look at it from below. Oh!
What's the news?
Ah, we have a row of Jonathan.
This is my friend Krista Mogensen. She's a backyard beekeeper. And she's just had a slightly heart-stopping but increasingly common moment. She's discovered varroa mites in one of her hives. Varroa mites, I hear some say. Well, perhaps you don't keep bees yourself, but you probably have heard mention of these little pests and their steady march across Australia since 2022.
The source of the devastating varroa mite outbreak is still unknown.
It's been more than a week since Australia announced it was abandoning efforts to eradicate varroa mite.
The bee-killing pest Varroa destructor mite has been found in Victoria for the first time.
But let's put these nasty critters aside for a moment and take a step back, away from testing and parasites and back to the thing that attracts most people to beekeeping in the first place, honey.
Get the spoon, taste, let it roll around your mouth, and you should feel like a foretaste, a middle taste, and also a back taste. This is eucalypt honey, so you will feel a back taste. So try that now.
I hope nobody has misophonia. You know the thing we don't like people eating on radio? Oh, that's lovely. Mm. Okay, it's coating my tongue, and you're getting that slightly bitter, slightly salty, those caramelly notes that you might get from, you know, a delicious caramel milkshake or some salted caramels that you eat, you know, like some the ones that your grandfather would have in his pocket, you know, that kind of thing. It's got a lovely, lovely warm caramel to it. I'm enjoying it, but I want more, but I don't want to double dip.
Oh, use the back of the spoon.
Oh, you've done this before.
Yeah.
Our honey eater is Emma Bickley, Saturday breakfast presenter on ABC Radio Canberra. And our beekeeper is Cormac Farrell, head beekeeper for the Australian Parliament House. Yes, Parliament House has beehives, a sign of just how popular small-scale and hobby beekeeping has become in this country, even in urban environments. Aided largely by advances in beekeeping technology, including Australian innovations like FlowHive that made keeping bees and harvesting honey easier than ever.
We didn't realise when we launched half of our audience was brand new to beekeeping. I think it's become so popular because it is so multifaceted and rewarding. So you've got the pollination aspect, which is really important, and that's a very rewarding thing, just simply keeping bees. And then if you look after your bees, then of course that amazing reward you get with incredible amounts of honey. There's no other insect or anything on earth that can produce that amount of such a beautiful product we call honey.
Isn't it funny how we all like honey? But getting back to those nasty varroa bugs, what does the future hold for our bee-reliant crops and for backyard beekeepers facing an unprecedented beepocalypse? I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science and history collide. This week, for love or honey, keeping bees in the age of varroa. Changes in people when they keep bees?
It changes the way you see food, and it sort of changes the way you see our place in the world. I think the main one, it changes how you see a landscape. You start to notice that seasonal change in the landscape, that something's flowering and now that's petering out, now a new source of flowers is coming in. You start to be really aware of where resources are and also where resources aren't. When it's empty, when you're seeing drought, when you're seeing torrential rain, you start to understand those flows of energy and nectar and food through the landscape. So my name's Cormac Farrell, and for my sins, I am the head beekeeper for the Australian Parliament.
A lot of people will be surprised at that description. They may not have been aware that the Australian Parliament had bees.
I don't get paid. It's purely for fun. It's but myself and a bunch of other volunteers. We've got a fantastic team of volunteers. It's not just me doing this. So we do keep bees. We keep 6 honeybee hives, and we also keep 2 native stingless beehives. And this is to highlight the role that bees play in our food security, our production of honey, obviously, but also the importance they have for the environment. So our native bees are so important for the environment and also for Indigenous culture. They're a totem for many Indigenous Australians.
A pretty good place, I imagine, to keep bees, Parliament House. It's surrounded by eucalypts and the native wonders of Canberra.
Absolutely. I think the landscaping team are the real stars of the operation. Flora from every Australian state is grown in the Parliament Gardens, and it produces this ever-shifting flavour of honey year to year. And it's fantastic because different things flower and that goes into the honey.
You're a pretty keen advocate for people keeping bees in urban Australia.
I am, but it depends on the bee. Not everyone should be a honeybee keeper and not everyone can be, but everyone should make a space for flowers if they can. And everyone should try and keep at least a little bee hotel for native bees. So you can absolutely do something for insects and pollinators in general, and if you feel up to it and you think you have the time and the space and you want to get into it, honeybee keeping is really fun. It's lovely.
So back to our honey tasting. Cormac is in Canberra and I'm not, which is why we called on ABC Canberra's Emma Bickley to be our honorary taste tester.
So this is honey from the Parliament hives. So this is the Australian Parliament honey.
It's rare that I'm speechless.
It's a small jar. This is the little gift jars that MPs would normally give VIPs, foreign dignitaries.
Ah.
So we have a Canberra celebrity here to taste. So it's only fitting.
I can't believe this is happening.
Very good, Emma.
I have been practicing. I wish that we had more of this to share around the office, but I'm going to take this home and not tell anyone.
That can be arranged, yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's like a little bottle of sunshine.
So where this has come from, so the Parliament Gardens will produce a different honey every year because we have dozens, hundreds of different plants. They flower at different times. Some flower more intensively. Some produce more nectar than others in a given year. So what you're really tasting mostly is yellow box honey, Eucalyptus meliodora, a famous tree. It produces some of the best honey in the world. And that's what you're tasting. This year we had a really big flowering of Eucalyptus meliodora, the yellow box tree. Also a little bit of Banksia and a little bit of Melaleucas come into that as well. So you get this really intense flavour profile. But yeah, so I mean, because these are VIP gifts. These go to presidents, other MPs from other parliaments joining us. So it's really nice. And it's used to seal trade deals occasionally because they always do a gift pack of Australian stuff. And
you sling the honey.
Sometimes a jar of honey ends up in that stuff.
How delightful. If I got this as a gift, I would sign anything.
That's the plan.
Well, Emma certainly succeeded in making me unspeakably envious. I wish I could try that honey. But we have delayed long enough. We need to discuss the elephant in the room, or rather the 1-millimetre-long parasitic arthropod in the room, Varroa destructa, an unsubtle name, but an apt one when it comes to its impact on honeybees. So how did the arrival of Varroa change things for the urban beekeeper?
Well, it's really going to sort out the people who are into keeping their bees and looking after them properly and those who perhaps are just a bee haver. So you're going to have to spend a lot more time monitoring for Varroa mites because you have to continually check the mite levels in your hive. So every hive will have mites in them now. We cannot get rid of the mites. They will be endemic across the landscape. So once they build up below a certain threshold, you do need to treat to sort of knock the hive levels down. And that happened recently for me. My orchard pollination hives, which are out in the country, they're pollinating an organic orchard. They had mite counts. The threshold is about 6 to 8 mites when you'd start to treat. They were all 30 plus in the alcohol wash test. So that equates, from a sample of 300 bees, that equates to thousands of mites inside each hive. And I was like, right, okay, got a treat. So we applied a treatment. And I'll have to do that sort of continually now. I'll watch, knock the mites down. I'll watch them build up again. Once they get above a certain threshold, I smack them over the head again using a different rotating set of treatments. The mites, unfortunately, if you use the same treatment over and over, they are very good at building up resistance, and the Americans have just had a very unpleasant experience in that. They used a single treatment, and last winter they lost 70% of their beehives, which is not a sustainable loss if it happens year on year. So they're in a really tough spot. In terms of managed hives, we're probably going to lose about 50% of our hives in this initial surge. So what's going to happen is we will try and treat our managed hives where a beekeeper's looking after them, unmanaged hives where a beekeeper's not looking after them, and feral hives where no one's looking after them, they're living wild, they become a huge surge breeding population for the mites. And the mites, as the hive collapses, bees go, oh, wow, look, free honey. They go in and thousands of mites jump onto the bees and get a free ride back to their home hive. So that's what's happening to my hives now. There's this flood of mites coming in from the wider environment. Eventually, all those feral and unmanaged hives die out, and then we get to a more manageable, hopefully, fingers crossed, touch wood, situation where we're just managing the hive, the mite levels in our managed hives. But that surge, it's going to suck.
Cormac Farrell, head beekeeper at the Australian Parliament. He's also the author of a book, Urban Beekeeping, The City as a Hive. From ABC Radio National, you're listening to Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. Varroa destructor mites were first detected in the port of Newcastle in 2022. In Melbourne, where I meet beekeeper Krista Mogensen, well, her hives are still Varroa-free. Well, they were. Yeah, we've already spoiled the ending for you.
What's the news?
Ah, we have Varroa, Jonathan.
But Krista is a wonderful advocate for beekeeping. She got me started in beekeeping myself. She was a founding member of the Melbourne Beekeepers Club, and she's worked with government on Varroa management. So let's rewind and head out. Protective suit on. Smoker in hand.
So it's quite a good day today. It's warm, the bees are happy. A bit more wind than we normally like. Sometimes with bees, if they're not happy with our visit, we will close up the hive and come back the next time.
And how do they let you know they're unhappy?
Oh, there's a number of ways. They do their little kamikaze dance at worst, which is to zap you in your face veil. And you'd generally be selecting your bees not to do that behaviour. You want calm, quiet bees. And people say a more aggressive hive is a better honey collector, but I think we can have both. I think we can have calm bees and honey. Let's aim for that.
Less honey and less pain simultaneously.
That's right.
So what's our job this morning?
I'm actually going to check for Varroa. I haven't found it in my hives yet. Let's see if today is the day. But we know it's coming. We know it's in Melbourne, which is where I am at the moment. So we'll want to see if we've got Varroa in the hives today.
It's a matter of time, isn't it?
I'm afraid so. They can live with a certain amount of Varroa, but too many and the hive will die.
And it's not a pleasant time for them, even with a certain amount.
No, that's right. What we know from Varroa is they make a little incision in the developing larvae of the bee and they feed off this. And this incision's not fun. It hurts and it's an impairment that goes with the bee through its whole lifetime.
Did you bargain on this when you began with bees?
Well, we knew Varroa was all around the world and we kept thinking, oh, there's something special about us. We will miss out on this.
Island continent.
Well, we know, we had hopes, but look, it's just something we couldn't do. And we're the last beekeeping continent in the whole world.
Well, it's what's now, 3 years ago they turned up in Newcastle?
That's right, yeah, 22 I think it was. And so we can actually learn from everyone else's tough experiences, and a lot of what we're doing now is thanks to the efforts of everyone around the world and New South Wales in particular. So we're learning, absolutely, we're standing on their shoulders and very grateful for all the things they can teach us. See this hovering? This is a really interesting thing, this hovering of the bees at the entrance. If it's a bee that's just come out of the hive, it's possibly a bee doing its little orientation flight.
A little baby bee.
A baby bee on its first outing. And what it's doing is setting its GPS. So it comes out the front, looks at back at the hive, and then does this sort of figure eight shape. And what that is setting its internal GPS so it can find its way home.
They are the most astounding of creatures. The more you learn about them, A, the more you realise you don't know, but B, the more impressed and fascinated. Off comes the top.
There's a nice crack. They've been sealing that with propolis to keep their hive really air type. But our job today is to go below this super, this honey super. There's another good crack happening.
It's a good seal, isn't it? Whew. And this is down into the brood box, the box beneath the super.
Yeah, so that's a brood box. Is it's both the maternity wing for the new babies and also a bit of their pantry as well. We're going to take a sample of 300 bees, or half a cup of bees, and sorry to say they're going to be sacrificial bees today. We're going to wash them in a metho mix, and we're going to aim to see if there are any Varroa mites in that sample.
Because the mites will drop off in that alcohol.
Yeah. When we take a sample of 300 bees, we really don't want to take the queen. It's bad enough we have to sacrifice 300 of the workers, but we're certainly not wanting to sacrifice the queen. So if I have an unmarked queen, I'm going to capture her and I'm going to mark her, put a little dab of paint on her back.
So she's more easily recognised.
Well, that's
in the hive.
Thing. That's
Some people
right.
do it depending on the year.
It can be helpful. It means if you mark your queen with that year's colour, you know what year, how old is your queen. Mm. Although we often get replacements. The hive decides they'd like a different queen, so they replace her. And that's the funny thing about this word queen bee. We think it's that sort of social context in the human world of the boss. But actually the queen bee is not the boss.
She's the hardest working woman in showbiz.
Well, she's the mother of the hive. Yes. There's no question about that. But she's not the boss. The decisions are made kind of collectively. Yeah, she's not the boss.
So. That's one of the interesting things about bees is their sort of sense of collective intelligence.
Oh, it is a world of wonder and mystery. Mm. And, you know, they're engineers. They've come up with this, the strongest of shapes is that hexagon. And they're amazing dancers. They come in from the bright modern world where they found a flower. They go into the hive and in the dark, they do a dance that tells their sisters where this new fabulous nectar
and how good
laden.
The nectar is.
Well, that's right, and where it is, exactly where it is. So these creatures.
Amazing.
They are incredible. Ah, look at this. Look at her now. Do you see that? Do you see a bright blue dot on that lovely long cylindrical creature?
Oh, yes, there she is.
There she is.
There we go.
That's the mother of the hive. That's our queen.
And she's moving about and people tend to get out of her way.
Well, as you must. Yes. There's our royalty there. So I've just got her in a queen clip. She's now suspended between two frames that I'm not going to be interested in. I'm interested in the frames that have some baby cells on them because it's the nurse bees we're after for sampling. Now, nurse bees don't fly, Jonathan. They look after the babies.
How do you pick them apart from foraging bees?
Well, only because sometimes they're a bit more furry, but the real test is do they fly? So here's my sample box. I'm now going to shake this frame of bees in here. And immediately the foraging bees will fly away and the nurse bees won't because they don't fly yet. It was a bit of a thud, but it harms no bee. I'm afraid the harm comes next. So this box of bees, the foragers are flying off and all these non-flying bees are nurse bees. I'll get my half cup measure, literally like kitchen work, and then I'm going to put
Sorry,
them
bees.
In here. I'm saying, thank you, bees. They took one for the team, I'm afraid. And then I'm going to shake these. And look, the idea is three lots of 15 seconds. What we tend to do in the real world is give them a mighty shake, go and do something else, come back, give them a mighty shake, go off and do something else and come back for a third shake. So we've done our three 15-second shakes.
Yep.
And we're going to now take the lid off this little container, and I'm afraid there are sacrifice bees, and we'll just shake off the
And we
extra.
Have our fingers crossed that there's nothing in that
well,
liquid at the
look,
base.
It's going to happen one day. Will it be today? So I'm going to look at it from below. Oh!
What's the news?
Ah, we have Varroa of Jonathan.
Oh,
okay,
Krista.
That's interesting. I can see one, two, three. Can you see this shape here? This
yep.
It's got a completely solid edge, and it's like a little sesame seed. These are Varroa.
So with that number, that quantity from that quantity of bees, what's your sense of the health of things? Is that...
Well, we've got Varroa here now, so I need to have a treatment plan.
What am I going to do? Yeah.
I need to think about it. I need to count the Varroa because that tells us the proportion of mites in the complete hive. This sample of 300 bees, we've got one, two, three. I'm calling it for four.
Yeah.
So we're pretty much on the borderline for treating. We have seven treatments we can choose from, a mix of synthetic and non-synthetic.
These are chemical treatments.
Yeah, they're all chemical treatments. Some are organic and some are made in a factory. We'd all love to stay organic. No one wants to put poisons in their hive. But there's, you know, what we hear from New South Wales, it's been really hard for them to keep on top of mites using only organic treatments.
I mean, urban beekeeping has become an increasingly popular thing. Is that message about varroa getting through? Are people being as diligent as they should?
Well, I think we're all in denial for so long. We've known about varroa for decades. We kept thinking we might be lucky. Mm. Then it came to Australia 4 years ago. And even now, people who don't have varroa think, oh, I'm not actually doing my washes because it doesn't feel real. So we need to become very good at this because the future will continue to be challenging for the bee world. And of course our food security and all the wonderful things that bees do for us. It is daunting, but join a club, get training, band up with your colleagues and your other beekeepers to make it easier for us to help the bees cope with varroa.
Krista Mogensen, a founding member of the Melbourne Beekeepers Club and an expert on varroa management. So a sad day for Krista's honeybees, but she's clearly prepared to face this new reality, and her optimism that varroa mites can be managed, it's echoed by Cedar Anderson, co-inventor of the Flow Hive.
We're over the hump, actually.
Okay.
So the good news for us is the worst of it's over in our area, and now the hives are starting to look good. The brood nests are looking good. It's much more stable.
Oh, that's brilliant. Cedar, you were born into beekeeping.
Yeah, look, my grandfather kept bees and I've got fond memories of being on his farm in Queanbeyan near Canberra, and that yellow box honey that comes in, whenever I taste that flavour, it takes me right back to my grandfather's hives.
Of course, it was you and your dad, you say, Flow Hive, you revolutionised the business of beekeeping.
Yeah, certainly. It was a lot of hard work for what we call an overnight success.
So for those who aren't aware and aren't familiar, the Flow Hive, the way in which that works, the mechanism of breaking that honeycomb and delivering honey to the jar so simply, that is a thing which is pretty radical, that took so much of the trouble out of harvesting honey.
Yeah, it came from this idea of, hang on, can't we do it a different way where they're pulling apart the hives, you're using a leaf blower to get the bees off, you're loading the heavy boxes onto the truck, you're taking it back to the shed, which was the shed I lived in, and making a big sticky mess, and I'm no good at cleaning up, so the mess gets worse and so on. You know, you're squashing lots of bees as you trample back and forth with all of the boxes. And the thought was, hang on, can't we do this in a simple way where we can just tap the honey out and let the bees be? So that was the thought that started what turned out to be a decade-long journey that my father joined in on.
The beehive has two sort of fundamental components. There's the box in which the babies are made and the box in which the honey is stored. And it's looking after that box of the babies that's kind of the most important part in a way.
And it's often the part that captures people.
Mm.
After a while, they go, yeah, the honey's an amazing bonus, but wow, look, I get to be a part of this matrix. And you've got the pollination aspect, which is really important. The Apis mellifera, the European honeybee, the bee that we all know, is a keystone in our agricultural sector because pollination completely relies on that species for so many crops.
So for someone in suburban Australia, with a single hive, there's a lot to learn, a lot to experience, and a lot of joy to be had, and you've made that easier for them. I'm wondering how that equation has shifted with the arrival of the varroa mite.
So varroa mite has definitely changed the game, and annoyingly, it's here to stay.
Hmm.
What happens, and for us in our particular region, it came a bit over a year ago. And what we saw was this slow build and then a hit real hard where a lot of the unmanaged colonies, be it in hives or in trees, die out due to getting weakened by the varroa. And then the hive beetle is a double whammy where the hive beetle come in and prey on that weak hive, and the bees tend to abscond and leave the mess behind. your hives then go out and rob the resources from a recently absconded hive, bring back the mites. And then what happens is that hive dies out and then you've got 10,000 more beetles, larvae crawling out of the hive into the ground. And so the process goes on. I'm happy to say, though, that we're over the hump in our area. So that went on for 5 months or so. And now what we're seeing is a very clear shift where it looks like those wild colonies have died out already, the ones that were going to die out, and we're no longer getting that load of varroa mites coming back, and levels of varroa in the hives will stay quite low for what seems like a long time.
And yet it's still, especially in the initial stages when you're first detecting the mites, when you're trying then to work out how you're going to organise yourself to help that hive, that's quite an increased load for the small beekeeper.
Absolutely. So we've all had to sharpen up as beekeepers, but it's also a lot of people that are learning and making sure they're on top of it, and that's a really important thing to be doing. The bees certainly need a bit of help when varroa first comes to the area. And it's fantastic that we have a lot of dedicated people making sure they're keeping their hives alive. That way we can carry those genetics through and then see how they really go when things are in a more manageable state.
How do you take your honey cedar, or are you well and truly sick of it after a lifetime?
Well, just yesterday I did get in trouble by my other half for sipping honey in the pantry. She's onto me. But I do like to eat a lot of honey. I really enjoy all of the different flavours and the vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients and actually some really quite medicinal properties that are in honey.
There's beauty in beekeeping, a closeness to the often hidden elements of nature and its seasons, a constantly growing understanding of a remarkable creature possessed of astounding collective intelligence. Varroa is a fatally destructive force in this one-time land of bees and honey. They need our help now, a little close attention. And for some beekeepers, well, that will be more than they were counting on. For others, well, it'll be another little tie that binds. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guests, Cedar Anderson, Krista Mogensen, Cormac Farrell and Emma Bickley. Cedar also has a book out co-written with his dad. It's called Flow Hive's Book of Bees and Beekeeping. You can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National and anytime at all on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Share us round like bees to a hive. And if you're listening on a platform that lets you write reviews, please do. 5 stars, thank you, or some kind words. That will help new listeners find our show. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.